Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the 2011 International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France.
The listeners to Issues Etc. already have had contact through the program with lecturers who will be in Strasbourg this next summer. Craig Parton, myself, Dr. Minuge, Angus Minuge, Adam Francisco, and these lecturers are people who have defended the faith, who know how to defend the faith, and who are marvelous communicators. And so, if a listener to this program wants to learn how to present the case for Christianity in a secular situation, the 2 weeks in the French Rhineland with us would be an absolutely ideal way to achieve this.
You can find out more about the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 5th through the 16th in Strasbourg, France, at apologeticsacademy.eu. Welcome back. It's Tuesday afternoon, the 25th of January, and the last half hour of Issues Etc. this afternoon. Part two of our five-part daily series on the Crusades with Dr. Matt Phillips. We're going to be talking about the Second Crusade, the shift in politics. Of course, history continues its march. Things never stay the same. But what was similar and what was different about the Second Crusade as opposed to the first? Our call-in number, questions or comments on the Crusades, 1-877-623-MYIE. Send your questions or comments to us here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org. Send them as a tweet at issuesetc or leave them at the Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back.
Good to be back.
In a nutshell, how was the Second Crusade the same and different from the First Crusade?
Well, the similarities are it was called by a pope. The warriors and those who went on the pilgrimage received an indulgence. It was a war, mostly between Muslims in the Middle East and Christians in the Middle East. So those are the main similarities. Some differences are, and we can mention some of these as we go along. While most of the war was centered in the same area as the First Crusade, that is, in the area of what today would be roughly Israel, the Palestinian territories, Lebanon, Syria, those areas, there was also forays into parts of the Iberian Peninsula and Portugal and Spain. That would actually kind of be a similarity with the First Crusade as far as the Iberian Peninsula goes. There was also part of the crusade that took place in the northern part of Europe, not against Muslims, but against groups called the Vins, who were probably some Germanic, some Slavic peoples who were not Christian, who had been attacking German settlements in what today would be northern Germany and Poland.
So it's a little more dispersed in its scope. The first one took place in about 1095 or so.
Right.
When does the second one take place, and what occasions it?
Good question. The Second Crusade takes place in the 1140s, around 1146 to about 1148. We historians over time have labeled these big events as like the first, second, third crusade. They obviously didn't call it the Second Crusade when they were participating in it. There were little crusades, if you will, in between them. At the end of the First Crusade, as we talked about yesterday, it was militarily successful, and they carved up the Western warriors carved up four main what are called states of the Latin East, sometimes called the Crusader states: the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the County of Tripoli, Principality of Antioch, and the County of Edessa. What occasioned, and that's roughly running from what today would be modern Israel through Lebanon, part of Syria, and up into northern Iraq. What occasioned the Second Crusade was a Turkish ruler from Mosul, the same city as the modern-day city of Mosul, which is in northern Iraq today. That Turkish ruler attacked and took the county of Edessa, which was the northernmost part of the Crusader states. And the word was sent back from Jerusalem and other places to the west that, hey, we've lost the county of Edessa. We don't know what's going to happen next. We fear this massive invasion force, and they might drive us out, so we need help. and the Second Crusade was essentially the answer to those calls for help.
So the Second Crusade was also, at least from the perspective of those who waged it, a defensive action.
Absolutely. Yeah, because they were defending the kingdoms. The now Christian, either the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which was kind of the main one, that would be roughly what today would be Israel or Palestine, the Palestinian territories, County of Tripoli, which is roughly what would be Lebanon today, and the Principality of Antioch, which would be north of Lebanon, that area. So they were defending the territories that they now inhabited.
Who was the pope that called for the Second Crusade?
It was a pope named Pope Eugenius III. He had been a monk, like a lot of popes by that time, a monk in a new order called the Cistercian Order, which is a very important order that develops in the 12th century, and a very important monastic order that developed in the 12th century and was very important. And it's, the Cistercian Order is still an order today in the Roman Catholic Church. And he had been a monk in that order and then risen in the ranks of the hierarchy, and then was elected pope probably in the late 1130s, I think.
Does he call for it the same way that Pope Urban called for the first one, as kind of God wills it, this is the this is what we must do to defend ourselves, but also this is what God would have us do by way of indulgence for sins?
Absolutely. In fact, he refers to, he says, by this time you have a crusading tradition. I mean, the people, the nobles, and now you'll have kings going on the crusade, the King of France, the Holy Roman Emperor. They have a crusading tradition. Their ancestors are the ones who, you know, led earlier crusades. They're related to the people who have settled, like in the Kingdom of Jerusalem or in Antioch. It's the same Antioch that's mentioned in the Bible, by the way. So they're related to those people. They have connections to them. There's a tradition. And he actually says in the letter he puts out, I give you all the same privileges that our predecessor Urban gave. So he gives them the same remission of sins. They also had temporal privileges, which meant like their property was supposed to be protected while they were away and these kind of things. That was to encourage people to go. Obviously, you're not going to want to go across halfway across the world and hoping you might return. A lot of people assume they might be killed or die. But if I do return, you know, I don't want somebody to steal my property while I'm gone. So the church would actually take that property into protection. There were laws and privileges that were put forth in canon law that said, you know, church will protect your property. Some people sold their property to monasteries and others to fund their crusades. And in fact, many people did that at great expense to themselves to go on all these crusades, including kings and very powerful dukes and counts, etc.
Why did the nobility, all the way up to kings, and you mentioned the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire,
right,
why did they go on the Second Crusade?
Well, the difference was they were in better relationship with the papacy by this time. The King of England at the time, the England was embroiled in a civil war. That's the main reason he didn't go. There were English knights who did go on the crusade. The King of France was Louis VII, who ruled a very long time in the middle of the 12th century. His wife at the time was a very famous woman from the 12th century. Her name was Eleanor of Aquitaine. She will later, her and Louis actually later get divorced, and she marries the guy that becomes the very famous King of England, Henry II. So she's a well-known person. And she was the Dutch, she would be the Duchess of Aquitaine, a very important part in southern France. So there were, like I said, all these nobility, including now the people who were the highest rank, the King of France, had ancestors who had gone on the crusade. It had become part of the family lore. And it was also seen, so there was a kind of a familial duty, but there was also a Christian duty. It is your duty as a Christian king to go and fight for Jerusalem and defend the Holy Lands against what they believed, of course, from their perspective, to be attack on what was now Christian property and Christian kingdoms.
How did it progress? When did it begin and how long did it last? I mean, war is a messy business at this time. It always is, but it takes a long time to get from where these people are ruling down to the Holy Land and then do it in such a way so that when they arrive, they can actually carry out a military campaign.
Well, by that time, you know, because they had these states, they still had a fairly decent relationship with the Byzantine Empire, which was centered in Constantinople. They'd have some problems with them. There was always, you know, political machinations going on. But Louis VII, and then the emperor was Conrad III, the Holy Roman Emperor. It was Bernard of Clairvaux, the famous Cistercian preacher, who convinces Conrad III to also what's called taking the cross. so they both led an army. Obviously, most of Louis's army were French knights and nobility and others. Most of Conrad III's army was German-speaking knights and their vassals and their soldiers. They both led armies. Like the First Crusade, they did take a land route, which essentially threw Eastern Europe, through what today would be Hungary and Bulgaria, maybe northern Greece, into Constantinople. They went into Asia Minor. A lot of Conrad's army was destroyed, actually, in Asia Minor, although he and Louis both made it to Jerusalem. The war lasted till about 1148. It was not militarily successful. They didn't even end up fighting about what they went there for, which was to try to take back Edessa. They just pretty much gave that up. They ended up attacking Damascus, which was the closest Muslim city, the current-day capital of Syria, the modern state of Syria, which is ironic. The attack failed ultimately, but it was ironic because the guy who actually started the war, who took Edessa, the Turkish ruler, was also an enemy of Damascus at the time. So they it kind of was a military bungle, to be honest with you, and I think most people see it that way.
They did the enemy that they went to fight a favor by taking out one of his.
In many ways, although Damascus was Muslim, just like not everybody that's Muslim was friendly to each other, just like on the other side, everybody that's Christian wasn't friendly to each other. So people didn't always understand that. I mean, I think that's a good lesson for history. You know, that's something I bring up in my classes. You know, it behooves us to know, today, or to look back at history and say, you know, what mistakes did people make in these kind of situations, and how do we better learn who our potential enemies are, or potential allies, or whatever. So that's a good example of that, I think.
When we come back, we're going to have 10 more minutes with Dr. Matt Phillips, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. It's part two of our five-part daily series on the Crusades. Today we're talking about the Second Crusade. He mentioned just a moment ago, very famous man, Bernard of Clairvaux, is really the main salesman, preacher, if you will, for this crusade. We'll talk about what he had to say, how he encouraged people toward the crusade, and what are the contributions he made in the life of the church. Our call-in number on this Tuesday afternoon, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can also leave questions or comments on the Crusades at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesETC.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly, issuesetc.org. Stay connected, issuesetc.org.
Would you like to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a regular, monthly, tax-deductible gift? We've made it easy for you to donate using automatic withdrawal. Simply fill out and mail the automatic billing authorization form under the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. No more writing monthly checks or making monthly PayPal contributions. issuesetc.org. Click donate and fill out and mail the automatic withdrawal form. Thanks for your support.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology. And we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good Theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find Good Theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. We're talking about the Crusades, in particular the Second Crusade today, in this the second of our five-part daily series on that subject. Before the break, you mentioned Bernard of Clairvaux and how he is instrumental in the promotion of the Second Crusade. Talk about that.
Yes, something to know about Bernard of Clairvaux is by the time of the 1140s, Bernard was a living legend. He was a walking saint in the sense that, you know, his reputation was huge. He had already done preaching tours as a preacher. He played a big role in what we would call church politics, in the probably what they call church politics, I guess, in the 1130s and even earlier than that. He must have been a very charismatic individual and a very charismatic, excellent preacher. He's described by sources as his preaching was so powerful, you know, that people would weep, and it reminds me of almost thinking about the way John Wesley's preaching is described, kind of a revivalist style preaching. I don't know what, but basically, he just had a great charisma. So he was already well known by this time. In the 1140s, he had also been a teacher to the Pope before he was Pope. Right, the Pope came from that order. So the Pope Eugenius called on him to preach the Crusade. He goes on a preaching tour of both France and parts of Germany, what today would be modern France and Germany. The King of France is just overwhelmed with his preaching. Bernard preaches in the spring of 1146 at the monastery of Vézelay. So many people come forward, the story goes, that Bernard has to start tearing his own habit to form pieces of the cross, because they actually put a sign of the cross on themselves. And they had not made enough to put on everybody, so he started tearing pieces of his own monastic garment to put on the people. It's a great image anyway. And he also goes personally to the court of Conrad III in late 1146 and convinces Conrad, basically calls him out and says, you know, Christ has died for your sins. What are you going to do for him now? I mean, what else can God do for you? And the image is the emperor falls on his knees and begins to weep. So this guy could talk to anybody, basically. You know, he could talk to an emperor like that, and they would listen to him.
So this is would be kind of the modern-day equivalent, let's say the 20th century equivalent of enlisting Billy Graham to...
Yeah, that's not a bad comparison. I mean, I think, and I want to say it positive in this sense. I'm not saying I would agree with everything either one of those people would say, but they were respected, and they were generally considered to be sincere and honest people. He wasn't an Elmer Gantry, you know what I'm saying? He wasn't a trickster. Most people would have thought Bernard of Clairvaux was a respected, good man. And I think the same with Billy Graham.
So essentially, the role that he plays is to, with his access through his popular preaching, but also with his access to the nobility, he plays kind of in the hand of Pope Eugenius III the role of making sure that every strata of society understands what this enterprise is about, and especially reminding the nobility and upwards of their responsibility in this matter.
Absolutely. And just like in the First Crusade, a lot of people went or wanted to go who weren't necessarily warriors, and he had open preaching, and a lot of people heard. So thousands of people heard and listened and went. But yes, particularly he could tap in because he came from the noble class himself. He understood them. Like I said, he was already extremely well-respected by that time. So, yes, he could tap into there. Billy Graham's not a bad comparison from the 20th century. You know, Billy Graham's been the pastor to the president and so forth. So there is somewhat of a comparison there, I think.
We're really talking here about kind of the heart of medieval Christianity and the kind of the beginning of medieval Europe in terms of its negativeness. Can we understand what European society is going to be from this point forward, the way that it's structured with the nobility and the knights and the warrior class and all of that kind of stuff, apart from these formative events in the first two Crusades?
That's a good question. I don't know if you can complete, I mean, because it happened, it's kind of hard to know. I think the Crusade is definitely a very important manifestation of knightly culture. That's what I think knightly culture would be a good way to put it. It wraps in both the ideas of Christian chivalry, of a true religious act that you're doing for Christ, right, and for the forgiveness of sins. But it also allows the knight to exhibit those great ideals of prowess and courage that go all the way back to the Iliad and the Odyssey. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, but both the temporal, secular idea of great courage as a great warrior, but also I'm serving Christ by defending these holy places, etc. So it allows the knight to express both of those feelings and ideas at the same time.
In that vein, Dr. Phillips, Jordan asks, what do the Crusades teach us about the Lutheran distinction of the two kingdoms?
Well, that is a very good question. I have to say a little bit about what Luther thought about the Crusades, and of course, you know, most Lutherans are familiar with the concept of the indulgences. I'm paraphrasing. There was an article about Luther and the Crusades that I have, but I don't have it in front of me, but basically Luther said, if you need to go fight as a soldier to fight the Turk, because they were fighting Turks in Europe, the Turks were invading Europe instead of the other way around in Luther's day, which shows you that ultimately the Europeans lost the Crusades, but that's another story. We'll talk about that later. Luther said, if I see a papal banner, I'm running the other way. So Luther clearly sees, you know, yeah, there are two kingdoms. God uses the kingdom of the left to deal with things like warfare, and he has soldiers and all those things, and a warrior and our soldiers to go out and fight bravely and do his duty. And that's what Christ has called him to in that vocation. But you do not thereby earn salvation or satisfaction or the forgiveness of sins in any way. So I think for me the biggest Lutheran distinction there is the biggest problem with the Crusades is the fact that it was a means by which people could earn at the very least satisfaction for their sins, and at the very most the complete remission of their sins. So It's definitely a mixing from a Lutheran perspective of the two kingdoms. The war or pilgrimage or whatever cannot earn forgiveness for you, obviously, or earn or work out satisfaction for you. That's the vocation you follow after you've already received Christ through the right hand, which is the church, the preaching of the word and sacraments. So I hope that answers the question.
A couple of quick questions as we wrap up this part of it, Dr. Phillips. Did the Crusades by this time, were they serving as a means by which the papacy could consolidate and strengthen its political prowess?
Yeah, I mean, from the very beginning, you could make that argument. I honestly don't want to be too negative. I think the popes were these popes were actually doing what they thought was the right thing. You know, obviously, I can't see back into their hearts or anything, but I believe.
Did it have the effect of consolidating and strengthening their political
power? Yes, I think in the 12th century it did begin leading towards that. There was a move in the 12th century in general, and I think the preaching of the Crusades were part of that move towards what's generally called the papal monarchy. And later this week we're going to be talking about a fellow named Innocent III, a Pope Innocent III, who kind of is the epitome of the papal monarchy. So yes, I think it did. In a big way, have that effect.
Tomorrow we're going to discuss the Third Crusade, or so-called Third Crusade, with less than a minute. What's on tap for tomorrow?
Well, the Third Crusade is probably the most well-known crusade, I would say. The movie The Kingdom of Heaven actually depicts the events right before the Third Crusade, the events that brought about the Third Crusade. So if people have seen that movie, or maybe I'll mention a little bit about it. The Third Crusade is the one that Richard the Lionheart leads as King of England. So this is like the next generation after the Second Crusade. It's about 40, 50 years later. So I think that's probably the most well-known crusade, most likely because of the Robin Hood story. Robin Hood, who was a fictional character, but a fictional character within the historical events of the Third Crusade. So a lot of people have heard about that, and in the story of Ivanhoe, which is the old movie and novel. So those... A lot of people have heard about those because of those events, and the most recent Robin Hood movie, which has a lot about the Third Crusade in it.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, I look forward to tomorrow's conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Tomorrow we will be talking about the Third Crusade. Our series with Dr. Matt Phillips of Concordia University, Nebraska will continue. We've got a new YouTube video that's out there. You may have heard about it. It's been out for a couple weeks now. It's called Good Question. A thanks to Pastor David Gallus for putting those together for us. He does a remarkable job. And this latest YouTube video, Promoting Issues, Etc., is no exception. You can put it on your Facebook fan page. You can put it on your blog. Find it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. Scroll down. You'll find the new YouTube video called Good Question. And underneath that, links to all of the previous YouTube videos. And again, a big thanks to Pastor David Gallus for all the work that he's done for us there. Help us promote Issues Etc. by sharing with your friends, your Facebook friends, emailing your friends, the new Issues Etc. YouTube video called Good Question. Issuesetc.org. Click support right there in the middle of the page. You'll find the video you can watch and a way that you can share it with all your friends. It is important that we understand that this is our history. We just look at it wide-eyed, completely honest. We evaluate it as Christians first and foremost for the theology that was behind it and that resulted from it. Well, from the Crusades, one might even argue that if you weren't promising the nobility at least a satisfaction for their sins or a full remission of their sins, indulgence for their sins, you might not have gotten them up off their thrones to go halfway across the world to fight in defense, at least they thought, in defense of Christendom. We cannot excuse bad theology there, and it really does show that false teaching has some pretty enormous consequences. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.